Since the topic was sort of left to my choosing, I decided that perhaps what I could do is to take a little time and give you a little bit of an update concerning the status of our church body and some of the things that are presently happening across the Synod, maybe prefacing that with three areas of encouragement that I wanted to talk with you about in your own personal lives. What I'd like to do is to, as I have done in the past, take about 30 minutes. We have an hour's time slot, is that it? It'll take about 30 minutes for me to do some sharing with you and then give you 30 minutes to share observations with me or ask questions of me, which I'll try to answer for you. I find that wherever I go out in the church, whether it's with pastors or with lay people, congregations or districts, the people of God really like the opportunity of asking questions and sharing observations. It was about 2 weeks back I was with a group of day school children down in Good Shepherd Lutheran School in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so I met with the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. They have about 300 in their school, so it was a goodly number of students. And I gave them a chance to ask questions. And, you know, the first one kind of just slowly raised his hand about like this. You know, finally he got it up. And after we got started, I think there were about 5 or 7 hands all at once that were always up asking questions. So I think people like to do that. We've distributed an outline to you, and I'm going to, during my 30-minute time slot, try to cover the various items on the outline. If we don't get through them all, at least I'll give you the opportunity at the end, if you see one that sort of tickles your fancy, to come back to it and ask a few more questions concerning it. Also at the end, if I could have perhaps 3 or 4 minutes just as a wrap-up, I think there's just one observation I'd like to share with you concerning our work together in the Synod. You notice under Roman numeral 1, I listed 3 areas of encouragement which I would like to give to you personally. And the first of those areas of encouragement is not to neglect the time that you need personally to be in the Word. I may have done that the last time I was here, and I have a suspicion if I come again in a year from now, I may do it again. Because it seems to me that that type of encouragement to my co-workers, the members of our church, seminarians, my fellow full-time workers here, is not only appropriate, but it's something that we need to hear ourselves saying again and again. I've said to the brother pastors out in the Synod that when I was at the seminary, I often heard people saying to me, well, when you finally get out of the seminary and you find yourself out in the parish ministry, then you will have plenty of time for personal time in the Word. Here it's dogmatics and systematics and all of these things, and you know, and you may be a little bit short on it, even though you're encouraged to be in it, but when you get into the parish ministry, you'll have plenty of time to do that. Well, that's not true. You will find that the same type of things that would keep you from a daily personal life in the Word here at the seminary are the same type of things that will keep you from a daily personal life in the Word once you have gone into the pastoral ministry of the Synod. And it took a few years for me to smarts up in this particular area. And finally, I recognized the absolute necessity for Al Berry every day to spend time in the Word of God. It was about 17 or 18 years ago that I determined that the first 45 minutes of every day, after I've showered, I would spend time in the Word and in prayer with the Master. And I find that Al Berry needs that if he is to be a true spiritual leader of this particular church body and if he is to live out his faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. I need, like everyone else, the daily assurance that God has removed my sins as far as the east is from the west. I need the daily assurance of God's almighty word that tells me clearly that he is with me and says, cast all your cares upon me because I care for you. And with one after another pronouncement that God gives to us, his children, through his word, I need that in my ongoing faith life. Don't wait, seminarians, until you have gotten into the pastoral ministry daily to be in the word. If you're doing it now with a bulldogged determination, continue to do it. And if you're not doing it now, find that unique time every day when disassociated from subjects, disassociated from assignments, disassociated from some sermon you're going to have to preach someplace or a Bible study you're going to have to conduct, disassociated from all that, you are in the Word alone for you and God and for the strengthening of your faith in Jesus Christ. When I left the Iowa District East to come to St. Louis for the presidency of the Synod, my brother pastor said to me, "We know your commitment to being in the Word, Al. You're going to find it's tough in St. Louis to have that type of time in view of the schedule that you'll have as the president of Synod." And I'll never forget what I told him. "Don't you dare. Don't you dare send me to St. Louis and take me out of the Word. Because that would be like cutting me off at the knees and telling me to run. You can't do it." The second one that I marked there is sharing the faith. And this sort of came as a result of a conversation I had with one of your classmates out at the International Center. He was sitting in on a kind of an open forum out there, a question and answer type of thing, where we were asking, allowed the people in the International Center just to sit down with the president and spend some time asking questions. And he said, "Well, what should I be doing as a seminarian?" I said, "Well, needless to say, you should try to pass, because I think it's rather important for getting out into the church." But the other thing I said is, already at this point in time, begin to look for those opportunities to share your faith. Again, I believe that during the time that I was walking through or proceeding through the seminary, I did not look for those opportunities that I needed to look for where I could share my faith in Jesus Christ with people who were around me. Not just with those who are unbelievers or do not know the Lord, but with fellow believers who need to hear what I have come to know in the Lord, like themselves, and need to hear and be built up in that conviction and that faith through my testimony or my witness to them. Look for opportunities to simply tell others what your faith means to you in Jesus Christ. Again, you've perhaps heard me say it when I shared with you the fivefold vision statement. I look for one opportunity every day in a one-on-one contact with people where I can share my faith in Jesus Christ. And I wish I could say I have done that for the last 35 years, but that's not true. It's only about the last 6 or 7 years that I have really found myself committed to doing that particular thing. I could give you one illustration after another where I have had the joy of simply sharing with someone the faith in Jesus Christ. I have kind of a unique way of doing it. I find myself traveling, flying a great deal, but also when I find myself in restaurants or something like that, and often I'll just say, "I have this unique goal of sharing my faith with one person every day, and for better or for worse, today you're it." That's not the Kennedy approach, but it's Barry's approach of sharing the faith. And you know, I have not had a single person yet, as we're flying from one place to another, unbuckle and jump. They've all stayed aboard. I'm going to give just one illustration. I was flying to Denver about 2 weeks back, and there was a lady sitting next to me with a rather floppy hat over her head, and kind of, I guess, what looked almost like a hippie dress, but I knew she was not. I had decided it's a 2-hour flight to Denver, so I've got plenty of time to do a little work first and then share my faith with this lady sitting in. And I had been boosted up into first class because I fly quite a bit and got an upgrade. She was in 3A and I was in 3C. Pretty soon she said, "I notice you've got a lot of crosses on your stationery there." She said, "I shouldn't really be looking at the letters that you've been leafing through." She says, "Do you work for the church?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, thank you for opening the door, because now I'd like to share my faith with you about Jesus Christ." And I said, "For better or for worse, I like to do that with one person every day." And she said, "Well, I need to tell you today it's going to be for worse." I said, "Well, boy, that's the first time I've gotten that answer. What do you mean by that?" She says, "I'm convinced that God does not want me and has no use for me." I said, "Why do you say that?" Well, to make a long story short, she had been diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years back and had a double mastectomy. She, a year later, was divorced by her husband. And she found herself with 3 children to raise, a 10-year-old boy, an 8-year-old boy, and a 5-year-old girl. And she had now just been diagnosed as having cancer in both lungs. And she said, "I don't think God loves me, wants me, or cares for me." And I had the joy of sharing with her the message of a God who loved her so much that he gave his life for her. And I would like to feel that as we sat there and talked with each other on the flight 457 to Denver, the woman who got off from the plane was a different woman than the woman who got on the plane. Because she had come to hear again the glorious message of the salvation that is hers in Jesus Christ, and with tearful eyes to accept him. So I say to you, whether it is to your spouse, to your children, to the people you come into contact with, daily look for those opportunities when you can share your faith in Jesus Christ, already now, not when you graduate, now, and have that joy in the Lord. The third, I say, wife and family, and I see I'm going to have to keep moving here. I just want to say, do not neglect, for those of you who are married, those of you who are single, you can kind of put this in the hopper for when you do get married. Do not neglect spending time with your wife and with your family. I get a lot of letters in the International Center. I read them all. About a few weeks back, I got two letters, one from a brother pastor who said that they had planned their life in such a way that they were going to spend the last years of their life, you know, after the kids were raised and all that was done, kind of just enjoying each other. He says, the only problem is that God took my wife at the age of 54. Another pastor talked about his children. He said, we just sent our first oldest daughter off to college. He said, and 2 a.m. the morning that she had gone, the morning after she had gone, he said, I went down into her basement bedroom and she was gone. All her stuffed animals and her clothes and all the things that were our daughter, they were gone. And he said, I sat down on the bed and I cried. He said, it doesn't mean I haven't been a good father. It doesn't mean I haven't spent time with them, but it does mean I should have spent more time with my family and I should spend more time with my wife. And he said, Al, when you get out into this church, please tell the brother pastors not to neglect their spouse and their family. It's also good advice for seminarians. Under Roman numeral II observations, we've had our series of district conventions. In our series of district conventions, after they were all over, and I went to 17 of the 35 district conventions, and I enjoyed it. When I told people I was going to do that, they kind of looked like, heek. I did enjoy being out with the congregations and the pastors and the lay people at the conventions. People said, well, what did you see as you zigzag back and forth across this church? What did you sense in these conventions? Well, the first thing that you'll notice that I listed there is a greatly increased positive attitude within the church. 2 to 4 years back, we had kind of a downer attitude as a church body, and we found ourselves sort of not valuing ourselves too highly. Well, I need to tell you that as I zigzag back and forth across the church and as I went to all of these various district conventions, there is a strong, positive attitude out there in the church. And we thank God for that. The second thing I noticed was a strong acceptance of the fivefold vision statement that I've had the joy of holding before the eyes of the church. A church body that is strongly in the Word, a caring church body, a church body that is boldly reaching out with the gospel, a church body that is not ashamed to be a confessional Lutheran church with all that that implies in the present day and age, and a church body that is marked by peace and harmony in Jesus Christ. And wherever I went, convention after convention, I would see and I would hear the delegates, pastors, and lay people alike saying, yes, that's the kind of church we want to be as we move into the 21st century. That's what we want to be. Then we have a commitment as leaders and future leaders to help our church under the Spirit of God become that kind of church as we move into the future. The third thing that I noticed was a desire to move ahead boldly in missions. Our pastors and our lay people, our congregations have a very excellent mission mindset, and they want this church body to be active and bold in sharing the gospel all around the world. The only downside that one occasionally finds here is that it is so easy for us to talk about sharing the gospel over there in Africa and over there in Latin America and over there in East Asia and over there, and to fail to share the gospel with that world of people who we come into contact with every day. And I see that as one of the main challenges that we have, is helping our people with greater ease simply to share their faith in Jesus Christ and not to hesitate to say what we're doing, as I shared with you. Share our faith and challenge our church to be that kind of a church body. The fourth thing I noticed is a growing awareness that we are a multicultural society and consequently need to become much more of a multicultural church body. Now, that can have a dual word of caution there. I think it is very easy for us to perhaps ignore or not look as intently as we should on the fact that there are literally, and by 2050, there will be a preponderance of people who are not Caucasian as a population of this nation. But the other thing is that as we work with our congregations, we have to help our congregations grow into becoming a multicultural church and not just walk in and think that we can give them some type of an ultimatum or dictum, you, a Caucasian congregation, tomorrow are going to be the following. We are going to have to lead them into becoming that kind of church body and congregations. The fifth thing I listed is personalization in our work together. This especially is seen out in the church when it comes to the giving of our people. We cannot pull away from or back away from the approach that we've used down through the years of a unified support system in carrying on the work of our synod together, whether it is supporting our seminaries, our colleges, the mission program of our church. That unified support system that we often refer to at the congregational level as missions cannot be walked away from. But by the same token, we have to give to our congregations and people a much greater opportunity to find themselves personalizing with the overseas and the stateside mission program of the church. They want that. The next point that I listed, there is a strong desire for spiritual leadership. And the best way I can talk about that is to reference back to what happened in Minneapolis at the Great Commission Convocation. They asked me to bring personal greetings, and I did. And in the process, I said what the church needs today is not CEO pastors, but pastors who are spiritual leaders of the people of God. And if you were to look at the videotape at that point in time, you'll notice that I was immediately shocked by the fact that the assembly interrupted me with long and sustained applause. What this church body wants of the national leadership, of the district leadership, and of the leadership of our congregations, pastors and lay people alike, is strong spiritual leadership. The next thing that I listed is a growing diversity. And this is something that we're going to have to watch very, very carefully among us, that the diversity does not become so prominent that we are not united together as a church body. One of the things that especially concerns me is this declining attitude reference to a confessional stance or theology. I put down here in my notes, we are more and more becoming a church body that less and less knows what we believe. I'm going to repeat that. We are more and more becoming a church body that knows less and less what we believe. And somehow, whether it is in the catechesis of the children in 6th, 7th, 8th grade, in the preaching that takes place from the pulpits, in the teaching that takes place in Bible classes, in the receiving of adult members into our congregations, we are going to have to re-legitimize with our people that there is a good reason for being Lutheran, not just Christian, but Lutheran Christians, that what we believe is clearly based upon the Scriptures, and that they're Lutherans because this is what we teach and this is what the Scriptures teach. And I become very concerned that that could happen, that we are more and more becoming less and less aware of what we believe. Other key issues that I saw out into the church, there are perhaps four or five key issues that come to mind. There's the question with regard to worship, style of worship, substance of worship. There's a question with regard to the role of women within the church. The question again and again surfaces out in the church about the confessional practice, a very appropriate and proper confessional practice that we as a church body have and ties us back through the ages, the practice of close communion. There's also very much the question out in the church with regard to pastoral ministry and the relationship of the pastoral ministry to the universal priesthood of all believers. Recognizing that that was the case, I have asked four different district presidents, each to prepare a four-lesson Bible study to be used by the laity, by our congregations, to be distributed from the president's office to the church at the end of February on those four subjects. I believe they are needed within the church. Well, I'm going to go down to other report items. I just want to mention ILLL. Perhaps as you have zigzagged back and forth across the church, maybe as you've even tied back into the congregations of which you are a part of member, you may have heard that there had been in a days past, maybe 2, 3 years, 4 years back, a certain degree of static that was beginning to develop between the LLL and perhaps the structured Lutheran Church Missouri Synod 1333 and what have you. I want you to know that that has all been smoothed out and we have an excellent working relationship with the LLL, and that the coordination and the tying together and the handling of our work together is running as smoothly as one could ever hope for it to run. And I need to say that to you, and I need to say that to the church. I listed as other report items here on your campus last spring, or I think it was in July, and the year before, and the previous July, we had the joy of commissioning and sending overseas in the last 2 years 146 new workers. Now, why do I say that? Why do I bring it up? Because prior to the Pittsburgh Convention, I had made quite a thing out of the fact how we had a declining number of overseas workers. And there were even those who faulted me for sharing that information with the church. 15, 17 years ago, when I was a mission director for the Synod, we had about 420, 430 overseas workers, and that had gone down to a number of about 220. And to me, that is not forward in missions, that is going backward in missions. Well, I'm happy to say that thanks to a consecrated, dedicated effort on the part of our mission staff and people who have volunteered and wanted to step forward and serve in those capacities, we have sent 146 new workers overseas in the last 2 years. Some of them lay volunteers, some of them called pastors, teachers, DCEs, but I think that's a cause for great joy in the Lord. In the 1992 convention, there were four things that sort of marked hallmark issues where we made dramatic changes. One was the dispute reconciliation process. An entire section of the handbook was removed and replaced with what we presently call the reconciliation process or the dispute reconciliation process. Seems to be running quite smoothly. Has some glitches in it that'll have to be removed in the 95 convention or be addressed, but at least it is running much more smoothly than I think many of us thought it would. The second thing that we did is to tie all of our colleges together into the Concordia University system. The reason for that was both financial and I think also somehow to get a little bit greater control over the increasing multiplicity of courses that were being offered at all of our campuses. The indebtedness, the operational checkbook indebtedness that our colleges had assumed had climbed to no less than $23 million. Now that's a lot of money to be in debt when it's operational debt. And there was a need to address that. So in a positive way, that issue was addressed, as well as somewhere tying them all together in a coordinated effort. And the Concordia University system seems to be working well also. Two other things that we did at the convention was to set up what is called the Mission and Ministry Council. That is a smaller group to do planning for the church rather than a large group. And the Conference on Congregational Services, which was meant to bring together five entities. Commission on Worship, and that I think will perhaps have to be reviewed and perhaps discussed at the 1995 convention. There were 11 districts that petitioned the Synod once again to take a look at that decision. But there would also be youth, stewardship, evangelism, and parish services. The big concern that I have had in that combining together has been the following, that we dare not lose ground by combining things together rather than seeing it as a way to move ahead. For instance, in youth ministry, if bringing youth ministry into that fivefold approach into one is going to weaken us in our emphasis in youth ministry, that's not going the direction we need to go. If bringing evangelism and stewardship into that fivefold congregational service emphasis is going to weaken us further in teaching the basic biblical principles of Christian stewardship and helping our people become greater witnesses for Jesus Christ, then we need to address it. But we're really looking very carefully at that, and I'm sure we'll be discussing it more at the 95 convention. Talking about the 95 convention, you see that I've listed there just basic information, the theme, the floor committee meetings. It just so happens that on Friday of this week, the nominating committee, which is 17 representatives from 17 of our districts will sit down and begin to prepare a slate of candidates to be offered to the convention. We also have anniversaries that we're observing as a church body, the 100th anniversary of World Missions, the 100th anniversary of Synod's assuming of deaf ministry, and the 150th anniversary of the founding of our church body. People, when I'm out in the church, often ask about full financial disclosure and the synodical debt. I need to say in connection with full financial disclosure that our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, synodically, district-wise, and at the congregational level, can accept nothing less than full financial openness and disclosure to the people of this church body. Now, there are some things that we will have to pull out of the hopper. For instance, if someone gives a large gift to the Synod and says, I do not want it to be known that I have given $5 million to the Synod, you kind of have to respect that, especially in view of $5 million, right? Or if someone finds a settlement of a particular lawsuit where a part of the agreement of the settlement is that the terms of the settlement will not be made known. Now, whether we should ever agree to that type of thing, I have my questions. But let's say that's the agreement that has been made, and there are some of those that have been made. I think we have to legally respect that particular court agreement that we've agreed to. But other than that, we absolutely must have full financial openness and disclosure. Often people will say, what is the debt of the Synod? And I've heard that question asked of the treasurer of the Synod on many times, and he says, well, what do you mean by the Synod? Well, do you mean all the congregations? Do you mean all the schools? Do you mean all the social welfare agencies? I think our people, when they say, what is the debt of the Synod? They want to know LCMS, Inc., the incorporated LCMS, Inc. And the debt of the Synod, took me a little while to find it out, the debt of the Synod is somewhere around $95 million. $50 million of that is capital indebtedness. $23 million of that is indebtedness, operational indebtedness that our colleges have accrued. About $7 million is indebtedness that we still owe on the International Center for the one-third ownership that the Synod has in that particular building. $2 million is indebtedness that we have overseas for properties there. $3 million is operational debt where we borrow from one fund in order to pay to another fund and haven't paid it back. Sometimes they tell me, well, that's not really a debt. And I said, listen, when I was back in the parish, if we borrowed from the cemetery fund to pay the pastor's salary, he still had to pay the cemetery fund back. Well, that's the indebtedness of the Synod. To me, we need to tell our people what it is, but then we need to make it very clear that we are not going to allow our church body to go further into debt, but we are going to have a plan and a process for paying that indebtedness off through the years and getting ourselves on a good, solid fiscal basis. Inter-Lutheran meetings. I'm going to have to take just a moment of your time so I can share this with you. Inter-Lutheran meetings, I had a meeting with the WELS on July 27. I went up to Milwaukee and met with President Gergel. I met President Gergel for the first time at a Big Mac's in the airport in Minneapolis. He was in one line and I was in another, and he came over and introduced himself, and he said, you're Al Behring, and he introduced himself, so we broke Big Macs together. And then I went up to Milwaukee, and we spent one entire morning together and had a very excellent meeting. I felt it was a very profitable meeting, opened doors of communication which should be there. On October 17, we had the second, we have two of these every year, meeting with the CLC, Committee on Lutheran Cooperation. Those meetings have in the past not really spent any time at all discussing theology. And at the last meeting prior to this one, I indicated that if we were going to continue these meetings, we had to spend time talking with each other about theology, and especially those areas where we have problems that need to be discussed. The issue that we discussed at this particular meeting, in addition to the other items that we took and that were of a non-theological nature, was the document of common calling. And you'll recall that a common calling is a proposal that is being placed before the ELCA for decision in their 1997 convention, in which they will declare themselves in communion fellowship with the Presbyterians, United Church of Christ, and the Reformed, and a parallel decision that they'll also have to make in 1997 is if they will also declare themselves in communion fellowship with the Episcopalians. We indicated to the representatives from the ELCA that this is highly problematic for us in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we indicated why it was highly problematic. We had a very honest, a very friendly, a very thorough discussion of the entire issue. I would have to say that as one takes a look at the approach which the ELCA is now using with regard to the role and the authority of the Lutheran confessions, the approach that they are now following is not a quia approach to the Scriptures, something which you will be asked and the congregations and the pastors of this church body are asked to subscribe to the confessions, namely, subscribe to the confessions not in as much as they are in agreement with the Scriptures, but because they are totally in agreement with the Scriptures. And they are moving in the direction of considering the Lutheran confessions, as they call it, a socio-historic statement of what the church believed at a certain point in time. Socio-historic statement of what the church believed at a certain point in time. Which then makes it very possible to move, we believe one thing now, 10 years from now we can believe something else, 10 years from now we can believe something else, and we have indicated that is totally unacceptable. Just to give you a couple quotes here, talking about the communion relationship with these other Reformed church bodies, the statement was made by Dr. Chilstrom, that the difference, or the different, what we have here is a different thought structure as to the presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper, but agreement on the purpose of the sacrament. Did you get that? A different thought structure as to the presence, but an agreement on the purpose. Well, I think we could have said that with the Reformed a long time ago, except that's just not where we would find ourselves being. And I say this not in any way to pick on the leadership of the ELCA or the direction that the ELCA is going, but so that you are aware of the fact that we are not on converging courses theologically, but we are on diverging courses theologically, and this is going to impact, very clearly impact, on the future relations of our two church bodies together. Well, I've chewed up my 30-minute time slot. If you want to talk about funding our work together, or the KFUO concerns, or the seminary, or discipline within the Synod, often when I'm out with the laity, they want to know, does the president really deal with these problems that are brought to his desk? I think you can move in any of those directions, and what I'd like to do is respect your 30-minute time slot and give you an opportunity now to ask questions of me. And I always enjoy this. So, who would like to be the first to jump in the pond? Okay, very good. And even the sticky wicky ones are good, so don't hesitate to ask those also.
My name is Craig Otto. I'm a SEM4.
All right.
And there's a perception that our university and college system is losing its identification with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I was wondering, are they accountable to the congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod or to their own board of directors? And what can be done to control false teaching?
All right, this is a very good question, and it's a concern that I hear out in the church, that with the adopting of the new Concordia University system, our colleges have in many respects been moved out from under the controlling entity, as it were, of the board of directors of the Synod, and have been placed under another incorporated entity that is responsible to the Synod in convention, but not directly responsible to the Synod through the existing structure, such as the board of directors and what have you. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, as long as one recognizes very clearly that as we move into the future, we do not need 11 or whatever we would say 12 institutions that are just general BA type of institutions, but they are definitely to be Lutheran colleges that teach Lutheran theology to the people that come there. And the question that I hear out in the church, is it possible for us to lose our Lutheran identity as we would want it at these colleges under the present approach? The answer is, I think, yes, it is possible. And I have asked for time at the next CUS meeting and the time with the next presidents, again, to share with them that concern which I heard out in the church again and again at the various district conventions, because they want these colleges to be Lutheran colleges. They want the people who go through there to learn the Lord Jesus Christ, if they're just coming in from an outside setting, but also to, what would you say, learn to know what Lutheran theology is and what have you. So that could be very much of a problem for us. Perhaps the awareness that the problem could exist is a good sign, And the main thing is now for us to address it. Now, did I miss half of your question? Did you have another part to it, or does that handle both of it?
Do you have authority?
Okay. In the case of doctrine, yes, the president of the Senate would have the right to, if false doctrine would begin to appear in the teaching on any particular campus, the president of the Senate does have a right to step in at that particular point in time and deal with that doctrinal issue. They do not divorce themselves from the doctrine of the Synod. And yet, I think I would also have to say the president does not have as much power in dealing with the colleges now as he did under the old system. Okay?
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Pastor Berry, Mr. President, my name is Sid Sandate from First Emmanuel Lutheran Church in San Jose, Missouri Synod. We have been there roughly around 40-odd years. My question under Roman numeral 2D is not before that. I want to preface that with saying that I want to thank the Missouri Synod for sending people out into the mission field, because through the mission field is where I learned about LCMS. And I've known several pastors of German descent, of course, that have come and with loving care has taken care of teaching the gospel to people. And this is very important. And the now what you're asking here about the cultural awareness into the church, we have at First Emmanuel made it a purpose to go that way. In fact, we call our church the mission of all nations, so that we have several cultures in the church. And I know that the church is committed to the Hispanic endeavor, for instance. The evidence of that is that there's 8 of us here at the campus now studying for the ministry. And this is great, and I appreciate that very much. And it couldn't be done if it wasn't for the Senate that would see to it, along with the Concordia Seminary and everybody else that's involved, all the boards that have to say yea or nay, of course. Now, my question to you is, how committed are you as president, along with the church, to follow through with the Hispanic movement in the church?
All right, that's a very easy question to answer. Definitely committed to it. I think we have made good beginning initial steps. We're not going 65 miles an hour yet, and you don't go from 0 to 65 in one surge. You go 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. But we are committed to a strong emphasis in multicultural ministry. And it seems to me, I've met with the Hispanic Task Force on, I think, 2 or 3 occasions. And I always like the positive optimism that the Hispanic Task Force projects. You know, I really like the positive optimism. And what they said to me in the first meeting, I will never forget. What this church body needs to recognize is what a blessing we as Hispanics can be to this church body. What a blessing we can be. And I think as we catch that vision and incorporate increasing numbers of Hispanic, Black American, Asiatic Americans into the church, we will see what a blessing they can be to the church.
We're truly blessed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions?
This question, introductions are necessary. Daniel Hahn, fourth year seminary student. This question is not directly related to your work as president of the Missouri Synod, but I was wondering if you had a bead on how the Common Calling document is doing in the ELCA.
Okay, yes, I think I can speak to that. From the comments that we heard at the CLC meeting, it seems to me that the Common Calling document is being received within the ELCA and will be passed at their 1997 convention. Now, there are certain possible glitches that could arise. They have tried to say that the entire that the document must carry all 3 church bodies at one time. And the reason they're doing that is because there can be differing theological things that you hear from the Presbyterians to the United Church of Christ to the Reformed. Okay? And they simply said, We're going to take all three of them at the same time into a communion fellowship rather than just one of them. And yet, as you sit there at the table and talk with them, I sense Bishop Chilstrom would be willing to back away from that. If they went with two instead of three, they would still be willing to go with two instead of three. But the human sexuality issue is one that Bishop Chilstrom said very clearly had been for him the greatest trial of his entire ministry. I thought that was very interesting. He says, the last year in ministry, last year in service to the Lord, because of the human sexuality document that they put out, has been a big problem. And he said, I'm going to try to keep that from coming before the General Assembly in the next meeting. But this issue, I think, will definitely come before them, and I would be surprised if it would not be adopted. That's crystal ball gazing, but from the leadership of the church, I get that signal. Yes.
Yes, my name is Spencer Milkey. I'm someone here from Danville, Illinois. My question is under Roman numeral number 3, letter C, number 4. You had said that there were 5 recommendations that were made, and one of those recommendations was on worship by the theology or the worship committee. Could you tell me, I have a 3-part question. Could you tell me what that recommendation was? And then you had mentioned that some of the district presidents had a problem with that. If you could say what their problem with it was, and then would you give your own opinion on it, please?
Okay, you're talking about the Commission on Worship as to whether it would be incorporated into the Council on Congregational Services. Am I understanding your question right?
Maybe I misunderstood you when you're talking about it. I thought that they had made some recommendations as to part of this conference.
Okay. Let me try it once again. Perhaps I didn't make myself clear. At the 1992 Pittsburgh Convention, the Senate decided to combine into one entity, 5 entities. And the 5 entities were 4 boards and 1 commission. The 4 boards were youth, evangelism, parish services, and stewardship. The commission is the Commission on Worship. They were to be all combined in the 1995 convention, working from 92 to 95 into one entity, which would be the Council or Commission or Conference on Congregational Services. The purpose was twofold, basically, I think, a cost-saving measure. And the other, a very positive type of way, not that it isn't positive to save some money, but a positive type of thing of saying to ourselves, you know, maybe they would interrelate more with each other, because it's very easy for 5 entities each to do their own thing and not to relate to each other. Since the action in 1992, the Commission on Worship has said, we do not believe that the Commission on Worship should be a part of the Conference on Congregational Services, but should remain yet a commission of the Synod because of the important role of worship within the church body. We're afraid that we're going to lose the important emphasis on Lutheran theology and Lutheran worship. 11 districts said in their conventions, Synod, take a second look at it in 95. Others said, great, go for it. So undoubtedly, that issue will come before the convention in 95. And the reason why the Commission on Worship feels that it should not be a part of the others is because they feel it'll only be a further watering down and minimizing of the important aspect of worship within the Synod, making it almost like a programmatic type of thing rather than a key functional thing of the people of God in worship and in their daily life. Does that help a little?
Yes, thanks for coming.
All right.
I misunderstood.
I perhaps did not make myself clear. Okay, yes.
President Barry, I'm excited about the emphasis on missions and all the new people that we're sending out there. But I'm wondering if there's maybe some plans in the future to provide means either through Concordia University System or the seminaries to actually train more missionaries, because I know I've talked to some men around here that are interested, maybe feeling that God might be leading them there, but there's nothing within the curriculum here or anywhere that we're aware of that can help us to look into those issues or maybe provide the training for that. So are there plans to move in that direction, to train missionaries in a specific way, or how do you go about that?
Well, I know here at your seminary, you have just gone through a very intense process of studying the whole curriculum, and the faculty is now step by step walking its way through that entire process, as I understand. Is that correct? Am I reading that? Okay. And I don't, Dr. Johnson and I get together about three times a year, four times a year at Tippins for breakfast and to stay in touch with each other. And the last time we were together, he gave me the folder that the faculty has here to read through it. I don't specifically recall in skimming through it that that particular emphasis was there. But it's one that I think could very well be looked at. Do we do it as a part of the theological training? Do we do it apart from in a continued process following one's graduation from the seminary? And you look at the seminaries down through the years, as far as I can tell, I think over the ALC and the LCA seminaries, they have used two different approaches. One is to do it afterwards, after a person has completed his theological training at the seminary, then give additional training for an overseas field. Others have used it as a part of the last year of theological training. And I just don't know where that all stands. Undoubtedly, I would be prone to have all kinds of courses available to our people to train them to become overseas workers, and that both at the colleges as well as at the seminary.
Okay, well, just to follow that up, before any of that falls in place, what would you do if you felt that desire right now? Where?
All right, I think the first thing you'd want to do is, here in the seminary you have a student advisor. Is that the person that would need to be contacted? Let him know that. He in turn can let the mission department know that you have that interest, and you would be interviewed, and the process would be for you to be interviewed by people both within the seminary structure and within the mission department of the Synod with you for possible assignment to an overseas area.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
My name is Aurelio Magarino. I was born and raised in Cuba, and I have a couple of questions related to the situation there. I know that in the past, the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod has had missionaries in Cuba, and after Castro came to power, they were asked to leave the country. And at this particular point in our history, I think a Castro government won't have many more years left. And I need to know if the Synod have any particular emergency plan to address the crisis that will come up when Castro leaves power. Any particular plan or any particular thought?
At the last board of directors meeting, or the one prior to that, Dr. Oshoni, who heads the mission department of the Synod, shared an updated report on various areas, and one of those was Cuba. And the recommendation was a transfer of the properties that we own in Cuba to a Lutheran entity in Cuba that they had been in contact through one of our field workers or something down there, or through, I think it was Dr. Gedra, who was on the mission staff. As far as us visioning ourselves of sending missionaries, Cubans, what have you, Latin American, into Cuba, I do not believe that is a part of the plan at this point in time. That doesn't mean it can't become a part of the plan, but I would concur with you. It's very interesting. I think Castro is on his last leg. Of course, other people have felt that a while back, and it's interesting how strong his leg can sometimes be. All right.
The second question has to do with the crisis in Guantanamo. Any attempt from the church to give some help, spiritual help, to the people that are, held in Guantanamo this time?
It seems to me that in visiting with the staff out there, that there are attempts to get help to them, financial, personal help, this type of thing, to the people there. All right. Okay.
Just one quick question real fast. Jeff Sparks, second-year seminarian. Would you be able to comment on your last topic on KFUO concerns? It had been in the air about the FCC and some problems they'd had earlier. I would just comment on where we're at on that.
All right, I'll see if I can. I don't even know whether I have the most current information, but I can tell you where this unfolded. As you are aware, the NAACP brought a judgment against KFUO with the FCC, Federal Communication Commission. And the judgment was based against KFUO AM and FM on two counts. One, there had been a numerical error in a report that had been sent in by KFUO indicating the involvement of KFUO and the number of non-Caucasians who were hired and working at KFUO. There was a numerical error, and they caught this. And the other is that it was felt that not adequate attention had been given on the part of KFUO in seeking minority groups to be involved at KFUO, either hired or working over KFUO. Now, in many cases, it seems as though this is a test case. Other religious broadcasters and entities feel that we are kind of being held up as an example to try to get the attention of many other people or many other religious broadcasters. The National Religious Broadcasters Association would say this. But be that as it may, we have filed a brief with the FCC, and the NAACP has filed a brief with the FCC. The FCC process would be the following. The briefs from both sides have now been presented to the judge, one judge, who will make a decision relative to the validity of the NAACP charge or the validity of our saying, we did try hard, and maybe we should have tried harder, but we did try hard. If I get the signals accurate, the attorneys that were engaged by the Senate in Washington, D.C., to represent us feel that more than likely the judgment will go against KFUO. All right? If the judgment goes against KFUO, it would then be FCC's prerogative to say we will not renew the licenses of KFUO, AM, and FM. These stations must go off the air. Without a license, the dollar value of the stations is zero. Nobody wants it. But there are plenty of people who would like to have those spots on the dial, especially the FM spot. What is it, 99? You know, you talk about a nice spot on the dial. That's one that country music, whatever, would just love to have that particular spot. If the judgment goes against KFUO, the Senate will then have to decide as to whether it will appeal. If the Senate appeals, then the briefs will be handed to a panel of three judges, and another 6-9 months could elapse. If that is ruled against us, I think the panel, it can be appealed a second time into a legal setting and tried another time. The problem that begins to arise is this is highly costly. We have spent so far a little over $600,000 in the KFUO lawsuit. That's a lot of money. If we were to appeal it, it would be another $600,000 more than likely. And so what we have to do is kind of walk with it step by step and see where it presently stands. But the NAACP filed a complaint, the FCC honored it, briefs have been filed, decision one will be made. If it is against us, it will be appealed. More than likely, I'm sure we will appeal it. Then you go to the next level and to the next level. And that's kind of where it stands. Does that help a little? Okay. All right, you got time for one more.
President Barry, I'm Scott Bruick, Sim 4 from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
All right.
And so my question leads to the next item on that list, the seminaries. Every time I go back to Fort Wayne, I hear questions to me about the future of the seminary there. Could you give us an update on the Fort Wayne Seminary?
All right. I think you are aware of the fact that the beginning class enrollment here, if I'm not mistaken, had 117, is it, something like that, in your entry-level class? 112, all right, 112. The entry-level class at Fort Wayne, I believe, had 47, which is a marked difference. I believe that that is undoubtedly reflective of some of the tensions that have existed at the Fort Wayne campus, both reaching back 2 to 4 years, but also some of the tensions that are presently on the campus at this point in time. Those tensions seem to center about administrative decisions in the professors, in other words, assigning new professors to new administrative responsibilities, removing other professors from other administrative responsibilities. I have been in touch with President Schmiel on 3 different occasions. We spent an hour and a half together at the Indiana Convention. We spent another hour together about a month after that. We spent another hour together very recently. And what I have tried to do, and I might say more correspondence is coming to the President's office here at the Senate level on this issue than anything that I have had during the 2 years I've been president. I think there are 2 folders in my files about that thick of letters that I have received from people expressing concern and they're not hatchet people. They're not off-the-wall people. They're hurting people. And they're people who want some questions answered, and they want to see peace at the Fort Wayne Seminary, and they want to see it moving ahead. I have tried to tell all parties involved that they need to, I guess, cool it and sit down with each other and talk this thing out and create a climate there that is a positive climate where brother professors can work together, where the administration can work together, where students can have a good academic setting and climate in which to study, and where the church can have joy in the work of that seminary. I hear again and again questions being raised, well, do we maybe want to just cut back to one seminary? I believe that we need two seminaries. If we are going to be the kind of church body that is boldly moving into the 21st century by sharing the gospel, we need a lot of students coming out of St. Louis, and we need a lot of students coming out of Fort Wayne. We can handle both of them. You take the age spectrum of pastors, there's going to be a great number of retirees in the next 10 to 12 years in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. But we don't just want to train you men in order that you can fill the spots where people are retiring. We want to be a church body with an expanding vision, and for that reason, I think we need both of our seminaries. But we also need, at both seminaries, peace, unity, harmony, concord, and I think everyone on the Fort Wayne campus, as well as everyone here, needs to be committed to that in the Lord. All right? Okay, you want to sneak one in quick-like? We got just about 2 minutes, and then I want to just one wrap-up.
Just a quick follow-up on that
last
question. Is there any thought about moving one of the seminaries to one of the coasts as a way of addressing possibly the multicultural issue as well as the other?
No, I've heard that raised again, and reaching back to Dr. Barth, I talked to Dr. Barth about that once, and he said, you know how costly it would be to close down one seminary and move it to the coast? The cost would be literally millions of dollars, and the other thing is that the cost of living for a student on the coast would be so exceptionally high that many a student would not be able to become a part of that particular seminary simply because of the high cost of living on the coast. And I think that those are some of the arguments. Undoubtedly, we need to have opportunities through extension on a whole variety of ways that I know the seminary here is looking at, whereby we can train Asiatics, Hispanics, Cubans, you know, what have you, both off and on campus, But to completely relocate one seminary, I think the cost would almost be prohibitive. Just as my wrap-up, and I see I got about 2 minutes to wrap up then. As I'm out in the church, often people will be asking the question, well, what are the key issues? What are the key issues facing the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? And often they expect me to say, well, the key issues would be worship, the role of women in the church, communion, office of the public pastoral ministry, megachurch. Those are the key issues that are facing the church. And they are key issues that we need to talk with one another about and address within the family of Missouri and within our church structure. But to me, the primary issue is not worship or the role of women. And I'm not putting any of these down. The primary issue that confronts our pastors and our congregations and you as future workers in this church is sharing with a world that is around us a life-giving gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, with congregations who need to hear that assurance of God's forgiving grace, and with people who do not yet know it. That is the primary issue of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, of the congregations that you will be called to serve, and of the world. And I say that not to minimize these other issues that we need to talk about, but also so that we don't pull our eyes off from the task that the Lord has given us in sharing with a woman by the name of Joanne on a flight 457 to Denver or whoever it may be, the fantastic good news that in Jesus Christ, we have peace and forgiveness with God and the hope of life everlasting. God bless you in your studies. God bless.